We got a Bible, we'll be turning to 2 Samuel chapter 19. We're actually going to begin in the last verse of chapter 18. We didn't cover that last week because it's so closely tied with what happens in chapter 19 that I wanted to do all that together. If you've got a bulletin, the back side is an outline. It's a little different this week. I wanted to try to change it up a little bit to force myself to take a step back from how deep I was getting into 2 Samuel and caused me to go so far along last week. So that's why it looks a little different. If you didn't grab one, there's some in the racks in the back. I've got three blanks for you to fill in this week, but we're going to work our way through this text together in support of our Bible Bowl program. A reminder, this afternoon at 5 o'clock, we'll have our Bible Bowl practice covering chapters 19 and 20. Everyone is invited. Before we get to verse 33 of chapter 18, I want to just kind of set the context of where we are. We are at the end of battle between the army of Absalom and the army of David. And David had given one instruction to his three commanders. That instruction was, you know, go easy on Absalom. In other words, don't kill him. And as most of you know, especially if you were here last week, Joab, who seems to be a relatively bloodthirsty individual, Sarah and I were talking about that in the car on the way here, of all the people that Joab kills through the story of David. But Joab and his armor bearers kill Absalom, and through the messengers, a Cushite messenger who is instructed by Joab to take the message to David, and also Ahimaaz, who runs after him, the message comes to David that Absalom is dead. And that's where we pick up in verse 33. David is on the far side of the Jordan River. He's in Mahanaim. He has been waiting for the message regarding the battle. He receives the message back. We pick up in verse 33, and this begins the section that I have simply labeled the mourning for Absalom. It says in verse 33 that the king was deeply moved. You go down to his quote. He says, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died in your place. Oh, Absalom, my son." It reminds me very vividly, my daughter Sarah and Kate before her, Kate was in, and Kate Sarah continues to be in the concert chorus at Lipscomb Academy. And they, as I'm sure all concert choirs do in high school, every year they build their repertoire throughout the year. They add songs, they add songs, they add songs that they incorporate into their concerts. And near the end of last season, and I think, Sarah, you said you're going to continue with this season. They began, only performed it twice, but they did a song called David's Lamentation. And it is about the loss of Absalom. And it pulls from that verse where he's saying, "Oh, Absalom, my son." It's a hauntingly beautiful song. But that's what comes to my mind, that David is in mourning. He's in mourning over his son, and he's so affected by the loss of his son, even in the midst of battle, that he, you know, prior to receiving the message, he had been at the gate of Mahanaim, and it says that he goes up into the chamber over the gate, which will later be called the House of David, which I find fascinating. But he continues to mourn. And if you go down in chapter 19, Joab, the commander, is told, it says, the victory that day was turned into mourning for all the people. It's like David is mourning so much that what should be a joyous occasion in the aftermath of this victory has turned into mourning for everybody. It's not like a victory. It's like mourning. That's why I called it that. If you go down to verse 5, Joab takes it upon himself to go in to see the king. And he goes in to chastise the king. So not only was he bold in disobeying a direct order of David, but now he's going to go in and chastise the king. And I thought this would be a good opportunity to visit something that I don't think I've really talked about much. And that is the relationship between Joab and David. Joab is more than just the commander of David's army or one of his mighty men. Joab is actually his nephew. I don't know if you've noticed this, and this was the best kind of family tree of Jesse that I could find, and it's really faint, but hopefully you can see it. But you've got Jesse up here, who was the father of David, but whenever you read about Joab, Abishai, and Asahel being the sons of Zeruiah, Zeruiah is their mother, not their father. And Zeruiah is a sister of David. And so Joab is actually David's nephew. There's a relationship beyond just being the commander of his army. And I want to highlight that because there's another nephew of David that comes into play or has already come into play that we'll talk about in just a minute. But Joab, his nephew, goes into him, and you heard this in the reading that Brother Lowell gave us this morning. He said, "Today you have disgraced all your servants who today have saved your life, the lives of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives." This, by the way, is in verse 5. "The lives of your wives, the lives of your concubines, in that you love your enemies and hate your friends. For you have declared today that you regard neither princes nor servants. For today I perceive that if Absalom had lived and all of us had died today, then it would have pleased you well." And then he goes on and says, "Go out and greet the people." Go out and greet the people. And that's exactly what David does. You go to the next section, and it says that, you know, the message begins to spread throughout the people that David is at the gate. And once David goes down to the gate to greet the people, all the people come to him. And by the way, all the people includes the people of Israel. Now, throughout these two chapters, you will see Israel and Judah referred to because, you know, Judah is the tribe of David. And they have had the longest loyalty to David, even before David became king of all Israel. And there will be a contrast between Israel and Judah. And here it's referring to Israel being those who had followed Absalom. Those who, when they learned about the death of Absalom, had fled to their tents. They also come for an audience with David at the gate. And so David follows the instructions of Joab, and he begins to have an influence over the people. Now, we come down to verse 9, and we move into what I have labeled as another section, and I'm calling this Moving to Jerusalem. This is David coming back to Jerusalem, and it's almost a mirror of what we saw when we covered David abandoning Jerusalem. So when David got the message that Absalom is gaining power, he's raising an army, he's gonna come against Jerusalem, David had left Jerusalem. And when it's recorded David leaving Jerusalem, kind of every step of the way on him leaving, it talks about who he encounters along the way of leaving Jerusalem. Well, the same thing is happening here when David's coming back to Jerusalem, is that we read about encounter after encounter after encounter of different individuals that he comes in contact with. The first that we read about beginning in verse 9 is, well, before we talk about the people he encounters, we read that in the tribes of Israel, across the land of Canaan, across Palestine, they're having conversations about should we bring him back or not. And part of the argument is, well, David saved us from the Philistines. Remember when David took power, the Philistines were the archenemy of the Israelites. And David conquered the Philistines, completely subdued them. He says, well, he saved us from the Philistines, but we anointed Absalom to take his place. So what should we do? So they're having these conversations, okay, the people of Israel. Now, in the meantime, if you go down to verse 11, David, he's not hearing anything from Judah. So Israel's having this conversation, should we bring him back, should we not? He's not hearing anything from Judah. That's his tribe. And so he sends a message to Zadok and Abiathar. Remember those are the high priests under David. He sent a message to Zadok and Abiathar. And if you look in verse 11, he says, "Why are you the last to bring the king back to his house? Why aren't you talking about bringing me back?" And this is what he says. Go down to verse 12. He said, "Say to Amasa." Remember Amasa? Amasa is the one that Absalom selected to be the commander of his army since Joab had gone with David. Now, again, something I did not highlight last week. Amasa is also a nephew of David. Okay? And again, go back to the family tree. Again, here's David, son of Jesse. There's Zariah, the mother of Joab, Abishai, and Azahel. And then Abigail, a sister of David, and her son, Amasa. And so Amasa is also nephew. And so here's what he says to his nephew. He tells Zadok and Abiathar, say this to Amasa, are you not bone, not my bone and my flesh? I mean, you're a blood relative. You're my nephew. God do so to me and more also if you are not commander of the army before me continually in the place of Joab. So he sends a message through Zadok and Abiathar to Amasa and says, I'm going to put you in Joab's place. Now, it's not explicitly said why he's doing this. But you can kind of read between the lines and go, David probably knows that Joab's the one that killed Absalom. And earlier, David definitely knows that Joab and his brother are the ones that killed Abner. You remember all the way back when they killed Abner? And David was not happy about it and he cursed Joab and Abiathar for killing Abner? So I think David's fed up with it. He's fed up with it. You may be the commander of my army, but you're not following my orders. You killed my son, so I'm going to replace you. I'm going to replace you with your cousin, with Amasa. Okay, I'm going to replace you. And so then if you go down to verse 15, as David is going down to the Jordan. Now remember, David's on the eastern side of the Jordan in Mahanaim. As he's going down to the Jordan, there are as a group and some individuals that meet up with David. Okay, it says in verse 15 that Judah, meaning the people of Judah, came to Gilgal to go meet the king. And then you go to verse 16. Who do we see? It's Shimei, who I think Sam calls Shimei. I love that. Shimei, the son of Gera, a Benjamite, who was from Bahurim. Now, do we remember Shimei? Do you remember him? When David was leaving Jerusalem and he comes to Bahurim, Shimei is the one from the household of Saul who is throwing rocks at David and cursing David. Remember him? And the mighty men surround David, protect him. And you remember Abiathar, who, by the way, is also a nephew of David. Abiathar said, let me cut his head off. Let me cut this guy's head off. And David won't let him touch him, right? Remember that? He leaves him be. And then as David continues on, Shimei is continuing to curse him, continuing to throw rocks at him. Well, now he's coming down to meet him at the river, okay? So Shimei, son of Gerar, a Benjamite, who was from Bahurim, and he came down there, verse 17, there were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him. So now he's there. Okay, but he's not the only one. Verse 17, we also read about someone we've read about before, Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul. Now, Ziba, if you go all the way back to chapter 9, when David was looking for members of the household of Saul that he could honor, and they led him to Ziba, the servant of Saul, who told him about Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan. Remember all that? And then later on, as David is leaving Jerusalem, he's abandoning Jerusalem, he encounters Ziba, who has 2 donkeys and a whole bunch of other stuff that he gives to the people of David. But he tells them at that time, Ziba tells him when David says, where's Mephibosheth? Where did Mephibosheth go? Remember David, Ziba says to David about Mephibosheth. He tells him, well, we'll get to that in just a minute. But anyway, he tells him what ends up being a lie about Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth doesn't want to follow you. So those are the ones that are there. And Ziba's there with his sons and with his household. Okay? Now, in verse 18, we go back to Shimei. Okay? And it says that, unlike before when he was cursing him and throwing rocks at him, says he fell down before the king when he had crossed the Jordan. So it means he falls on his face in front of David. And this is what he said. Verse 20, I, your servant, know that I have sinned. I, your servant, know that I have sinned. And then, who speaks up again? The same one that spoke up the first time. Abishai says, again, Shall not Shimei be put to death for this because he cursed the Lord's anointed? Abishai jumps up again and says, hey, let me kill him again. And David again says, you know, what do I have to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? You sons of my sister, you know, what do I have to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? And he tells Shimei, you shall not die. Now, is that a permanent profession? If you know the rest of the story, which we're not going to get to in Samuel, but in Kings, on David's deathbed, he tells Solomon, take him out. Kill him, because he cursed me. Kill him. And so this is a temporary reprieve. But the one thing, you know, again, I've said this every week, that when you go through these narrative stories like this, the hardest thing is application. It's application. Is what do I, you know, how do I take this and apply it to my life? Now, as always in the Old Testament, there's the big picture of how God is using all of these events to work out his eventual plan. I mean, because he brings his Messiah through the lineage of David. So that's an overarching thing for all of this. But even in these individual encounters, I do not know what was on the heart of Shimei. I have no idea. I don't know if he's admitting his sin or saying I was wrong because, I kind of buckled up my wagon to Absalom and now Absalom's dead and I better fall on my face and ask for mercy. I don't know. Maybe that's what it was. But whatever the case, he said, I was wrong. Okay? Whether he believed it or not, he said it. And that's one of the hardest things for people to admit, right? It is for me. There's a commercial. I don't watch a lot of live television. About the only thing I watch is sports. But there's been, for the last couple years, especially in sporting events, these series of ads called He Gets Us, which are supposed to be about Jesus. Now, I know nothing about the organization that puts those on. So I'm not saying like, hey, go donate money to this. I have no idea. I like most of the commercials. But what it does is it shows you some situation, and then it basically says Jesus understands the situation, He gets us. Well, there's one that's been on recently where they're interviewing a few folks who are, you can tell that English is not their first language. And they've learned to speak English, and they ask them the question, well, what's the hardest thing for you to say in English? And they think, well, they're asking about what words are hard to say or what concepts in English. And one guy says, well, anything with a TH is hard for me to say. And then they're like, no, what's the hardest thing for you to say? Like, not because of hard to pronounce, but it's hard to actually make yourself say it. And one of the people says, the hardest thing to say in any language is, I was wrong. I was wrong. Or I'm sorry. Right? And whether Shimei was sincere or not, I think it's a reminder to us that it's important to recognize when we're wrong and be willing to say when we're wrong. By the way, it's so important that Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, when he gave the Beatitudes, and I believe the Beatitudes are, they all build upon each other. I often talk about them like a stairway. It's like painting a picture of what a servant or a subject in God's kingdom, what their characteristics are. And the very first one is, blessed are the poor in spirit, which means, blessed are those who recognize their spiritual poverty. Blessed are those who can look and go, I'm a sinner. I'm unworthy. Because if you don't get to that step, you're never going to go any further. You're going to go your whole life and go, I don't need anybody else or anything else. I'm just going to rely on myself. And so again, whether Shimei was sincere or not, I think it's a reminder that it's important to recognize when we're wrong and be willing to say it. Is that important in marriage? Yeah, that's important in marriage too. Okay, let's keep going. So David spares him, at least for now, okay? And then we come down, by the way, I was going to talk about Abishai again, but we'll move on. Now we come down to, Ziba has come down with this group, but also coming down now in verse 24 is Mephibosheth. Now, it doesn't mention that Ziba is in earshot of this or not, but it's an interesting conversation. Mephibosheth comes down. As a reminder who Mephibosheth is, Mephibosheth is a grandson of Saul, son of David. He's lame in his feet because as they were escaping, the nurse that was holding him fell and his feet were damaged, and so he's lame. And remember that when David was leaving Jerusalem, he encountered Ziba, who was the servant. That Ziba, when he asked Ziba, where is Mephibosheth? If you go back to chapter, you can just listen, you go back to chapter 16. He says, where is your master's son? And Ziba said to the king, indeed, he is staying in Jerusalem. So Ziba said, no, Mephibosheth's staying in Jerusalem with Absalom, by the way. For he said, today the house of Israel will restore the king of my father to me. And then David looked at Ziba and said, all that belongs to Mephibosheth is yours. Anybody remember that? Remember how that happened? He gives Ziba everything that belonged to Mephibosheth. But then he asked Mephibosheth, why didn't you come to me? It tells us that when Mephibosheth comes down to meet David at the Jordan, it says this in verse 24, he had not cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he returned in peace. Meaning that Mephibosheth had been in mourning, right? He had been distraught. And he says, you know, when David asks him, why did you not go with me? And he says, Lord, my servant deceived me. Remember the two donkeys that were with David? I mean, were with Ziba when David encountered him? Mephibosheth says, that was supposed to be for me to ride out, to be with you. And so the servant lied. But this is the part that I love. So David, recognizing that he's been deceived, he says, all right, well, you and Ziba divide your possessions. So I give them all to Ziba, but now you divide them. And Mephibosheth said to the king, this is verse 30, rather, let me give you an alternate proposal. Let him take it all. Wait a minute, you mean the one that deceived you? The one that caused your possessions to be given to him rather than you? He says, let him take it all, inasmuch as my lord the king has come back in peace to his own house. I think that's an incredible demonstration of contentment. Mephibosheth had earlier said that, you know, David, you allowing me to be at your table, you're like an angel from God. You allowing me to eat with you and be like one of your sons, you're like an angel from God. And now he's saying, I don't need anything else. And I think this is another one of those things that's really hard for most of us to say, I can be content with what I have right now. I can be content. Remember Paul in Philippians 4, where he said, you know, we tend to jump to verse 13, you know, verse 13, I can do all things through him who gives me strength. And we misapply that to say, you know, hey, God's going to help me do this bench press today. You know, no. What he's saying is I can face any situation in my life. Because he said, I know how to be high, I know how to be low. And in any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being content. He says, I can do it all because Christ gives me strength. I can be content no matter what. And it's so hard, though. Human instinct has said, if I got something, I want more. I want more. I want more. Remember the parable of the guy who, you know, built bigger barns? And, you know, then he said, he wanted more and more and more. And Mephibosheth says, I don't need more. I don't need it. David's offering it up to him. And he goes, I don't need it. I don't need more. He's content. Wow, what a powerful lesson that I need to learn, that I need to hear. Go down to verse 31. Another encounter. He's not yet to the Jordan, but another encounter. Barzillai the Gileadite. I had not called him out specifically last week, but if you remember when David leaves Jerusalem, crosses the Jordan, he goes to Mahanaim, and it tells us that he's weary, his people are weary, his men are weary, and there's a whole bunch of people in Mahanaim that give them a lot of things, including a place to rest. Well, Barzillai is one of those who took care of David and his men. And so David, on the way back, encounters Barzillai, and he returns the kindness. And he does this by saying, Barzillai, I want you to come with me to Jerusalem and stay with me. You know, I want you to be part of, you know, part of my family. I want you to be part of my people. And Barzillai, it says in verse 32, Barzillai was a very aged man, 80 years old, and had provided the king with supplies when he stayed at Mahanaim. And go down to verse 33, it says, the king said to Barzillai, come across with me, and I will provide you while you are with me in Jerusalem. You took care of my needs. I'm going to bring you with me to Jerusalem, and I'm going to take care of all your needs. And then you go down to verse 37. He says, please let your servant turn back again that I may die in my own city. He says, I don't want to go die in Jerusalem. I want to go in my own city. I want to stay home. But send in my place, and he mentioned Chimham, let him cross over with my lord the king and do for him what seems good to you. So he says, send somebody in my place, and he does. Okay. And then you come to the last part of chapter 19. And it's kind of interesting because you have the people of Judah and the people of Israel that are arguing with each other over their share of David. And it says at the end, yet the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel. They're fighting more for David than Israel's fighting for David. And that's how we end chapter 19. We pick up in chapter 20. And the very first verse of chapter 20, we're introduced to a man named Sheba, who in some translations, and I put this in the handout, is described as a worthless man. In the New King James, he's described as a rebel. But we're introduced to Sheba, who is a Benjamite. Okay, and this is what he says. He blows a trumpet, and he says, we have no, this is verse 1, we have no share in David, nor do we have inheritance in the son of Jesse. I have labeled this section the malcontents of Israel. The malcontents of Israel. It says, we have no share in David. Kind of the opposite of Mephibosheth, who's content. He's content to just have David back. Now we have the malcontents, Sheba. He says that we have no share in David, nor do we have inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel. Verse 2, so every man of Israel deserted David and followed Sheba. So now we're back to Judah and Israel, right? I mean, we're almost headed back to another division where the people of Israel follow Sheba, okay? So then we have a one verse kind of aside. David's now back in Jerusalem. And David takes his 10 concubines. You remember that when David left Jerusalem, he left 10 concubines in Jerusalem to keep his house. And then Absalom, under the advice of Ahithophel, took the concubines of his father. He defiled them. Well, now David comes back and he puts them up in the house. He never goes to them again. And so they are essentially living in widowhood. And this reminds me, I've emphasized a couple times about how, remember when Nathan told the story to David about the sheep? And David, you know, came to, you are the man, all that. And afterwards he said, you know, the sword's never going to leave your house, never going to leave your family. Well, also he said, someone's going to come in and take your concubines. You know, someone's going to come in and take your wives. And that's what Absalom did. And so it just kind of brings to remembrance of, you know, David is still dealing with the aftermath of his sin with Bathsheba and Uriah. So we move down to verse 4. David, who now has placed Amasa in charge of his army, he goes to Amasa and he says, I want you to gather an army of Judah. And I want you, within 3 days, I want you to have this army assembled and I want you to go after Sheba. But then it tells us that after 3 days, Amasa was not back. He missed the deadline. So, look at verse 6. David said to Abishai, that's one of the priests, now Sheba the son of Bichri will do us more harm than Absalom. David's getting afraid. He's like, Sheba's going to build an army. It's going to be worse for us than Absalom was. And so Abishai goes to Joab. And Joab, verse 7, Joab takes his men with the Cherethites, the Pelethites, those are the mercenaries, the foreign mercenaries who are the bodyguards of David, and all the mighty men, they went out after him. And at Gibeon, just north of Jerusalem, we've read about Gibeon before in 2 Samuel, at Gibeon, who does Joab encounter? He encounters Amasa, who David had sent out to gather an army. And Joab, as per his character, he pretends to be leaning in to greet Amasa with a kiss, grabs his beard. I mean, this imagery is vivid. And it tells us that Joab was in his full armor, and at his waist he had a sword hidden. And as he leans in and grabs his beard to lean in to kiss him, what does he do? He reaches into his armor, pulls out the hidden sword, and he stabs Amasa. And if you want to read all the gory details, they're all in there about what spilled out and all that, okay? And then Joab and his brother keep on after Sheba, but, and this is a weird kind of recording of this, but again, the Bible doesn't spare any details. Talks about the body of Amasa still there in the road, and people are stopping to stare at the body. It's like rubbernecking when you see a wreck on the road and everybody's driving, they're like turning, you know, and all the traffic slows down. Well, all the traffic going after Sheba is slowing down because they're all stopping to look at Amasa, and so they move him, a young man moves him off the road and covers him so that he won't be a distraction. I mean, again, the detail is crazy, right? And then they end up catching Sheba. They end up catching Sheba at a place called Abel Beth Makah. Now, this place is obviously a walled village or a walled city. And Joab lays siege to the city. Sheba's inside. And as they're begin to building up mounds to get over the wall, a wise woman, she's described as a wise woman, comes out and basically begs for her village. And this is what she says. Go down to verse 18. It says, they used to talk in former times, saying, they shall surely seek guidance at Abel. Now, Abel most likely was inside this village, and Abel literally means a meadow. So I think this is describing a meadow that's inside this village. They used to say that they will surely seek guidance at Abel, and so they would end disputes. I am among the peaceable and faithful in Israel. You seek to destroy a city and a mother in Israel. Why would you swallow up the inheritance of the Lord? What she's saying is, this is an important city, important village. Why are you going to destroy it? And so look at what Joab says. Joab goes, go down to verse 21, the last part of verse 21. He says, he tells this wise woman about Sheba. And then he says, deliver him only and I will depart from the city. If you give me Sheba, I'll leave. And she goes one better than that. She says, watch. His head will be thrown to you over the wall. Again, no sparing in the details, right? She says, not only am I going to give him to you, I'm going to throw his head to you over the wall. And it says, they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it out to Joab. Then he blew a trumpet, and they withdrew from the city, every man to his tent. So Joab returned to the king at Jerusalem. I'm going to end the lesson there. There's a little bit at the end of chapter 20, which is a revisiting of the administration of David, which we have talked about before. But it's just kind of a recap of who's in charge of what during this time in the life of David. And so David has, in his army, had defeated Absalom, and now they have stopped this rebellion of Sheba, who has led the people of Israel. And so for a moment, the people are back together. But we'll pick that up next week, Lord willing, in chapter 21. As I said, I think there's three lessons that I look at that. Anything in the life of David, I think there's the lesson of God working to bring about his ultimate plan. We started reading about that in chapter 7 where he said, I'm going to establish your house forever, your throne forever. I'm going to build you a house, David. But in this lesson, with Shimei, whether he was sincere or not, being able to admit you're wrong, being able to recognize your own weaknesses, your own faults, your own mistakes, and being willing to admit those things. Critically important in life, in your physical life, but way more so in your spiritual life, to be able to admit to God when you're wrong. And otherwise, you'd never seek God if you didn't admit that you needed him. And the second thing, there is, I think, a big lesson here about contentment. So much of this story is about being discontented. Whether you talk about Absalom, you talk about Sheba, but then in the midst of that, you've got Mephibosheth, who could have lived, he could have chosen to live his entire life like a victim. He's lame in both feet. His father has died on the battlefield. He has to be cared for. He has to be helped everywhere he goes. But instead, he says, I don't even need anything else. I'm just happy that you're back. And what a beautiful example of contentment in the midst of all this discontent. And let me tell you, we live in a world that is not content with anything. And can we strive to be almost like an oasis in the discontented desert of being content with who we are, what we have, and more importantly, who we serve. If you're here this morning and you don't know that contentment that can only come through the peace that is given by Jesus Christ, we encourage you to submit to Him this morning. If there's anything else we can do for you, please come while we sing our invitation song.